You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivastava Prakash.
This episode of Market Champions is brought to you by Simplify ETFs. For more information, go to simplify.us. No Simplify ETFs will be discussed in this episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today I've got Jim Chanos, founder and president of Kynikos Associates. Jim, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's fantastic to have you on.
My pleasure.
Awesome. So Jim, you know, the one thing that's been on sort of everyone's minds lately, or sort of the biggest development, has been this blow up of FTX. So, you know, when you saw that, you know, what was the first thing that came to mind? And, you know, what are your thoughts on it? You know, how are you looking at it?
So when the amazing SBF interview on Bloomberg dropped in April, it was on a Monday afternoon when I teach my history of financial fraud class. And after reading the interview, over coffee right before my class, I scrambled to try to get the actual article up on the screen for my students. I thought it was sort of a jaw-dropping event whereby SBF, the founder of Alameda and FTX, really, you know, made some just stunning admissions in that interview, if you remember, about how crypto worked, how yield farming worked, or how it didn't work. And he sort of, as I said at the time, said the quiet part out loud many times about the nature of the economics underlying these businesses. And so I guess we shouldn't be shocked when someone who basically admits to running a Ponzi scheme, is revealed to possibly have been running a Ponzi scheme. And that's really, nobody after that April interview should have been keeping a dollar at FTX. And again, remember, these are unregulated entities. I keep stressing that. You know, one of the advantages of fiat over crypto is, of course, not only regulation, but the existence of deposit insurance. So that, God forbid, something like this happens, you don't lose your life savings. And that is going to be the one area that crypto is going to be found wanting going forward, no matter what happens, is the ability for people to lose everything in a case of fraud.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah. And so, you know, one interesting perspective that I sort of read about was sort of a comparison between Enron and FTX. So, you know, of course, Jeff Skilling and SBF have very different personas, but, you know, overall, it sort of seemed as if both firms sort of promised to revolutionize trading, you know, Enron for energy and then FTX for crypto in different ways, of course. But then they had a lot of hubris. They talked about the shiny objects in a similar fashion. Then at the end of the day, you know, they were both massive frauds. So, you know, is this sort of a perspective or dynamic that you agree with? What's sort of your take on that?
Well, I would say that SBF was probably the anti Jeff Skilling in terms of he was everything personally that Jeff Skilling wasn't, right? Jeff was very slick and polished, and SBF, I think we probably all could agree, was probably not slick and polished, but that was part of his persona, clearly. But what is, as you point out, very, very similar is the whole nature of the black box. At the time, Enron was a trust me story. And when I would ask the sell side analysts, well, just how are they making their money? They would sort of say, well, it doesn't matter. They just do. And they beat their earnings projections every quarter. And it's a black box. And you just have to have faith. And I said, well, you know, if they're going to defraud you, isn't that exactly how they would do it? And so, you know, fast forward 20 years and we see the crypto industry following a little bit of that model. Now, there are obviously differences, but another big similarity is that both Enron and FTX fit one of my fraud models that I teach that was from Marianne Jennings, The Seven Signs of Ethical Collapse. And in that book, she has a wonderful 7-point checklist of companies that have committed serious fraud and some of their attributes. And Enron ticked all seven. I think I was conversing with someone the other day who knows the model, and we kind of agreed that SBF and FTX ticked off six of the seven. So, you know, these things are not always exactly the same, but they share a lot of the same characteristics.
100%. And so, you know, with the FTX story, so sort of the consensus, as I understand it, seems to be that sort of Alameda ran into trouble with the FTT token dropping like crazy. And then, you know, and then there's something fishy that happened behind the scenes, and that led to FTX blowing up. Do you think FTX was a Ponzi scheme just from the start, or do you think it was sort of a good organization, at least at the initial stages, and then it went on to sort of quote unquote make mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, very few large scale financial frauds start out with the idea that we're just going to steal from people. Usually what happens is it's a combination of the business model either, you know, not working and being covered up, or large losses incurred in trading and in large scale economic decisions like an acquisition or what have you. And then that's being covered up with bad accounting. It looks to be that at least from what we know right now, that the FTX Alameda complex began to lose money, not only trading, but in making just lavish spending and all kinds of sort of investments that went sour. And at that point, they crossed the line into using customer funds.
Yep. Okay. And you know, just on that note, so, you know, one thing that we have seen is Binance has sort of tried to become, you know, a JP Morgan savior kind of organization. So one, what's your take on that? And then two,
well, that's what SBF was trying to do after after the May collapse of Luna and Terra and Three Arrows. So
Voyager as well. So.
I mean, yeah. So I think I tweeted out, just, you know, be careful of this JP Morgan, self-anointed JP Morgan savior thing. It's kind of a bad sign. Look, I these markets are bigger than one individual. And when someone says, well, I have to be the savior or I have to ride to the rescue, you should be very suspicious. We'll leave it at that.
100%. The other thing that, you know, you also tweeted just sort of on this was that, you know, at this, and I quote, at this point, you have to be insane to keep your money at any crypto exchange. So, you know, one, is Coinbase sort of one of the next dominoes to fall? Because what we've really seen is, so companies like BlockFi have discussed sort of their extreme exposure to FTX and the FTX collapse. And, you know, there's a potential bankruptcy filing coming from there. And BlockFi is a big player within this. So, you know, one, is Coinbase the next dominant overall? Is this sort of the end of the crypto mania?
Well, so Coinbase is a slightly different situation. Coinbase is based here in the United States, which is a big help. The problem Coinbase simply has is its model doesn't work. You know, there doesn't have to be fraud for you to lose money as a Coinbase shareholder. Now, I think a Coinbase depositor probably is in okay shape. But again, there's no deposit insurance here, even though it's in the United States. And if Coinbase does do something that they shouldn't, depositors and people who are holding coins on the exchange would be at risk. Again, I don't think they're doing that, and there's no evidence they're doing that. Their problem is simply they have a high cost model in a market that is about to compress their commission rates. And that's a different story. You know, Coinbase is still charging retail customers 1.3% of assets per trade. And so, you know, that's a round trip of 2.7%. And which means you make four trades a year with Coinbase and, you know, it's 10% of your capital. That's a big, big drag. And they're charging institutions a fraction of that rate. And so it's only going to be a matter of time before Fidelity and Vanguard and everybody else who offers crypto trading is going to just completely undercut Coinbase for the same basic services. They're just simply an executing broker. So there's no advantage to being there versus another well-respected site. So that's number one. Number two, the bull case kind of morphed this summer into Well, don't worry about the losses. Number one, they're going to get into a bigger institutional business with their BlackRock deal. And that took the stock from 50 to 100. The problem with that deal, of course, is that the institutional business is tiny because the commission rates are so much smaller. And so the vast majority of Coinbase's revenues are still coming from retail traders, not institutions. And they don't make any money in the institutional business and probably never will. So that was sort of fallacy number one. The funnier pivot was when the bulls told me that, well, okay, yeah, commissions will probably come under pressure and the costs are too high, but they're going to stop paying their customers interest on cash balances. Well, okay, that's fine, but how long can you get away with that, of not paying interest when everybody else, again, Schwab, Fidelity, Vanguard, are going to be paying clients interest on their cash balances? You know, that's just a fundamental basic expectation by customers. So if you have to bolster your P&L by doing that, you've got a problem. So, I mean, Coinbase just simply has a business model problem. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, one more point was, you previously mentioned, some of the, you previously mentioned the seven signs of ethical collapse is one of the frameworks that you teach in your fraud class. Another idea that you've previously discussed is this, that the fraud cycle follows the business cycle. Now, one, do you think we're towards the end of that dynamic where it's time for the fraud cycle to actually sort of open up? So one, we started to see the business cycle. So, stuff within manufacturing, housing, et cetera, go down the toilet. But beyond that, we've also seen maybe FTX as an example come out as a fraud. And, that might very well be an idiosyncratic event. But do you think we're towards the end of that dynamic, sort of finally time for fraud to, quote unquote, come out?
Yeah, so what I've said is that the fraud cycle follows the business and financial cycle. So, and that's an important distinction, the combination of the two. Look, I think that the global economy's probably peaked at some point, either in early 2022 or late 2021. The 2021 financial market was probably the most speculative market I've seen in my 40 years on Wall Street. I mean, whether it was meme stocks, whether it was SPACs, whether it was the rise of crypto, NFTs. You go right down the list. 2021 had all of it. And so I think that now we are probably past that peak. And if my observation holds, we're going to start to see more and more revelations of fraud going forward. And we certainly see that now in the crypto space. I suspect that major frauds that we've had in the past 5 years, like Valiant and Wirecard and Theranos, were sort of the outliers and the preview of what we're probably going to see going forward. And it's going to be pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And so, within that, so do you think most of that sort of fraud coming out is going to be within sort of the crazy growth companies that, we sort of observed in, the aftermath of the March 2020 crash, say late 2020, early 2021. The Cathie Wood ARK stock, do you think that's where we're going to see a lot of this fraud coming out be concentrated?
Well, so again, we've already seen a lot of it, right? We've seen the crypto space go from $3 trillion to $800 billion, and we've seen massive revelation of fraud there. So that's already, the crypto guys are already in the category of the Enrons, WorldComs. I mean, they're big. These are big frauds. So it's already kind of started. One of the areas that I think is going to come under a lot of scrutiny, and it won't be go to jail type fraud, but it's still going to be, I think it's going to really hurt investors, is just the vast number of Silicon Valley business models that are inherently unprofitable, that were propped up by the use of pro forma accounting. I've been going on and on for that for now the last couple of years, but just the massive amount of share-based comp that gets added back to pro forma earnings and a variety of other metrics that Silicon Valley has come out with to tell you that their business models are inherently profitable when they aren't. I mean, just take a look at Uber's income statement or or Lyft or DoorDash or any of these companies where they're losing massive amounts of money and have been for years. And then by adding back, you know, a variety of different expenses, they get to break even or slight profit or what have you. And meanwhile, the Gap financial statements just keep showing hundreds of millions of dollars of losses. And I think at some point, investors are going to have to come to grips with that. And then they're going to, of course, wonder why didn't the SEC step in and, you know, restrict the use of pro forma metrics. But it's still in use massively by Silicon Valley.
And so, you know, just on that note, so you mentioned Uber, Lyft, and so these companies have sort of become extremely notorious for using, say, adjusted EBITDA numbers to sort of measure their performance. And, you know, you can adjust EBITDA in any way, you can add back whatever, et cetera. You know, one of the things that's interesting about kind of companies like Uber and Lyft is, in a way, they have a very, quote unquote, low cost business model. So if you think about it in theory, you know, they don't own any of the cars. They don't really have, it's not really a capital intensive business, say like Tesla or like Ford or like a car company. You know, what is it that, you know, keeps these companies, you know, as unprofitable as they are? Is it just poor management? Is it additional competition? Because really the biggest players in the taxi space, for example, are just Uber and Lyft. So, you know, what is it that is actually holding these companies back?
Well, the advantage they have is also their disadvantage, right? In that if they're a platform company, they have this huge advantage of not having the fixed assets, as you say, or even more troubling, depending on your politics, the reality of calling their employees, right? They're all independent contractors in the US, not in other countries. And so the employer doesn't have to pay, not only doesn't have to pay benefits, but doesn't have to withhold taxes, doesn't have to pay unemployment insurance, I mean, all kinds of things. That's the good news. The bad news is it makes them obviously susceptible to competition from anybody that's got their own car or taxi company. And that's exactly what's happened. So, for example, in New York, where I'm talking to you from, it is now routinely much cheaper to take a cab than Uber. Uber was much cheaper than cabs pre-pandemic. So Uber became, you know, ubiquitous. Everybody had an Uber app and would call an Uber and it'd be at your door and, you know, 5 minutes and take you where you want, cheaper than a yellow cab. Now, yellow cabs are 30, 40, 50% cheaper than Ubers. And so, you know, the reality is that the same advantages they have from not owning the asset or having the employee as an employee now are working against them in many markets. That's number one. Number two, there's lots of costs to these platforms you don't see. People are always surprised when I point out the biggest, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, costs for these companies is insurance. They get sued a lot for what their drivers, or excuse me, their independent contractors do. And so their insurance costs are massive. It's one of the biggest line items and costs they have. But look, I mean, if you're a DoorDash and you didn't make money delivering food during the pandemic, when are you going to make money? I mean, that's the other thing. These companies basically had these markets to themselves for years, or had a pandemic window that was, you know, will be hard to ever replicate. People stuck at home getting checks. That's a pretty good setup for being a food delivery company. And you couldn't make money then. As we say, if not then, you know, if not now, when? And that's the other inherent problem I have with a lot of the gig economy companies. You know, they haven't made money for years. DoorDash's losses per order are increasing, not decreasing. So the business is reverse scaling. And if you're a platform, a software-based app platform, the one thing that your business should do is scale, right? The more customers you run through it, the more profits you should have per unit.
Yep.
That's not happening. So that's a fundamental flaw with the business model.
Yep. And I think, you know, the other, on another note, especially as it relates to, say, DoorDash's, for example, sales numbers, one thing that seems to be very, very common for companies like Uber Eats and DoorDash is they just give coupons upon coupons to a lot of their customers. And this is something that's very prevalent in Canada, which is where I'm based. And I'm guessing it's probably in the US as well, but you know, it's just very interesting because when you give away those, say 25% off or 50% off or whatever, you know, on those kind of transactions, you just, companies like Uber or DoorDash just lose money. So it's sort of an exercise in futility.
Well, and the switching costs are very low. Like the same thing with the online sports betting companies. You know, you have all, if you're a sports bettor, you have all the apps. You know, you don't just have one. And if someone's offering you a better set of odds on a game or a more interesting parlay bet on a game, you're going to bet with them. And so at the end of the day, you know, the ability to switch by the consumer is very, very low. You can go to Uber Eats, you can go to DoorDash, you go, you know, to a variety of local vendors, or the restaurant itself increasingly. So when switching costs are very, very low, it's hard to get premium, premium built up over time on your customer base per unit. And that's what the gig economy guys are finding.
Got it. Yeah. One of the other things that I wanted to mention was, you know, especially with a lot of these growth names. So one of the things that we discussed when we met in New York was how companies, even in this kind of market where, you know, stocks are sort of going down on a general basis, are still increasing their stock-based compensation numbers. And I think, you know, that's very, very fascinating because so Voss Capital has published sort of this research piece where they sort of highlighted that if you take into account stuff like stock-based compensation, the true underlying operating margin is about 1% for a lot of these software companies. And I thought that was absolutely insane considering how SaaS companies have become well-known for operating margins. But then two, you know, what are your thoughts on that? And you know, what is actually going to change the dynamic of, you know, these ridiculous amounts of stock-based compensations, you know, that executives
have themselves? Yeah, it's an insidious problem for lots of reasons, not least of which just the accounting that we discussed earlier, you know, where people think something's profitable when it's not. That's bad enough. But there's other aspects of it, of a heavily equity-based compensation system that people kind of forget. And we saw it in the dot-com era to a lesser extent when options were being used and not being accounted for properly. The use of a heavy equity-based compensation structure is almost pro-cyclical. And by that, I mean, the higher your stock goes, the fewer shares you really have to give out for a given dollar value of comp. Conversely, the lower your stock goes, you get into a vicious cycle where you got to issue more and more equity for a given dollar value of compensation. But it's even more insidious than that. And this last part is the part that everybody kind of doesn't realize. If you have a very lavish equity-based comp system and you have an acquiescent board, a board that really rubber stamps everything management wants to do, particularly with compensation, if you issue lots of equity comp to your management team and your employees, and the stock goes down, and you are willing to then give them even more equity comp to offset, to not only what you would have normally given them, but to offset the losses they've incurred in their stock options and restricted stock units that you gave them a year ago. In effect, a year ago, you were granting them put options as well as call options. And everybody forgets that. Because when you value an equity-based comp system for accounting purposes, you use a Black-Scholes model, give or take, right? You use volatility, you've given a bunch of people a bunch of options at this strike, and it's a 10-year option, so this is what it's worth. Well, that's what you have to run through as compensation expense. Of course, non-GAAP, you add it back, but on the GAAP statements, that's how you do it. However, if the reality is when you grant them that lavish set of options, is a year from now, if the stock is lower, you're going to have to grant them even more for a retroactive basis for what you gave them a year ago. You've in effect given them a put as well as a call, and nobody is valuing the puts in the income statement. And so it really means that SBC, as bad as it is probably more expensive than you think it is when you run it through the income statement. So it means a lot of these Silicon Valley models are even less profitable than they look.
So potentially even negative operating margins if you take into account the put options.
Yeah.
One that's absolutely nuts. And two, you know, how do you think, you know, corporate America as a whole is going to go or maybe even specifically just the Silicon Valley SaaS companies are actually going to resolve it? So how do you think this ends up getting resolved? Do you think this sort of dynamic actually just sticks along for, say, the next decade? You know, we're eventually going to see some sort of bull run at least sometime over the next 10 years. So do you think this sort of dynamic persists, or do you think it's eventually going to go away? People are going to become more sensible, or investors are going to become a little bit more sensible with the way they pay their managers?
Yeah, I think it'll probably be like many things. It'll be a combination of things. It'll be a kind of a revulsion in all of this. I think that stock option packages will have to be revalued. I think that they'll end up being mostly cash. And then a lot of business models, investors are going to have to look at these models and say, well, wait a minute. You know, I'll give you a great example, Coinbase. Coinbase had revenues below $600 million this past quarter, and their share-based comp was slightly below $400 million. Let me repeat that, $600 million and $400 million. That's insane. By any accounts of it, that's just crazy, right? Two-thirds of their revenues were share-based comp. So, you know, either people are going to have to get paid a lot less at Coinbase, or, you know, the company's ultimately just going to fail. And so it's going to have to be some combination therein, I suspect. But a lot of these models don't work at all. If you really account for this stuff properly, and that's still ahead of us, or companies that, you know, that you know a lot of them, I know a lot of them, that are reporting some small amount of profits, but when you account for this stuff properly, are losing money. You know, they're probably going to have to come to grips with that and change the way they pay people and or charge their customers or make fundamental changes to their business model. You know, take a look at a company like Salesforce.com. I mean, it's a huge company. Compare their GAAP statements to their pro forma statements. It's an eye opener.
Massive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, 100%. And I think, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up was sort of, you know, this dynamic or this divergence between economic profits and accounting profits. So, you know, you can play a bunch of accounting tricks, you know, add back stuff, et cetera, and report a profit at the end of the quarter at the end of the year. But then, you know, in reality, the company is losing money due to, you know, sort of the various expenses that we were just discussing. So, you know, on that note, you know, one of the things that's sort of important to define is this difference between, you know, creative accounting is, you know, as it relates to it's within the rules, but then at the end, you know, you're still reporting, you know, you're playing tricks with the numbers and you're reporting a profit, but it's still within the rules, you know, versus, you know, what is typical or what is outright fraud. And so one, you know, how would you differentiate between those two situations? And, you know, it is obviously going to take a lot longer for the market to adjust to, you know, companies that play tricks with their accounting versus proper fraud. So how would you go about, you know, investing within that situation?
Well, so one of the reasons these stocks have come under more pressure, I think, than the market as a whole, of course, is because interest rates have gone up. And with interest rates have gone up, your discount rate, you know, goes up in the DCF models that people have to use to value these companies, because, you know, many of them aren't profitable or are barely profitable, so are dependent upon, you know, looking out 10 or 15 years and then discounting back the future profits and the terminal value. And that's a lot different at 6% than 3% or 2%. So that's number one. Number two, you know, it's going to depend on the companies and the industries as to, you know, whether investors wake up on this. You know, for years and years and years in the 80s and 90s, cable companies were valued just at incredibly high valuations, because people added back the depreciation amortization. It was the first really aggressive use of EBITDA was in the media business, and particularly the cable TV business. That was the first place I saw it in the 80s. And if you looked at the actual you know, financial statements, cable TV was one of the most capital intensive media businesses there was. I mean, stuff was always breaking. You needed trucks, you needed, you know, replace the cables, stuff went down in storms. I mean, whatever have you, CapEx was always just, you know, a meaningful part of EBITDA. And it took years. I mean, people were buying these systems based on EBITDA, and it took years for the compression to happen. But ultimately it did. And cable became a much less attractive investment in the 21st century than it was at the end of the 20th century when people realized that. So it'll probably depend on you know, just how long people are willing to hold on to these kind of flawed metrics and put a discount on them. But you know, cable, it went on for 20, you know, almost 20 years.
Yep, 100%. And you know, as it relates to flawed metrics, you know, one of the things that people have used to value or to price a lot of these stocks has been the price to sales metric. And even though these companies may be producing losses, you know, they take the sales numbers. And especially if it's a SaaS company, you know, what we've seen is, you know, then usually for a quote unquote normal business, it tends to be, let's say, maybe 1 to 2 times sales. But you know, for a lot of these companies, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, 100 times sales, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. So, you know, the expectations that get priced into stocks like this is absolutely nuts. And, you know, the point that you made at the start about how we're seeing interest rates rise, and, you know, that goes into these DCF models that, and, you know, that now output lower valuations. One thing that, you know, we have seen over the last 10 years, partly due to lower interest rates, was, you know, we're sort of the crazy growth manias, the NFTs, crypto, et cetera. If higher rates end up persisting, you know, what exactly happens to a lot of these growth stories? Do you think, you know, we're going to see more sensible investing over, say, the next 10 years if these higher rates persist, for example? Or do you think, you know, we might still end up we're going to end up seeing some sort of bubble anyway?
Well, two observations on that. Number one, a lot of business models that you know, basically survived and grew and maybe even thrived under really low interest rates are going to have a harder time if interest rates don't go back to the heady days of zero, you know, zero rates and QE forever. You know, I'm thinking of things like commercial real estate and other things that were based on 3%, 4%, and 5% cap rates. You know, the you know, cash flow divided by cash acquisition cost, and a lot of those things we've already seen it in the office sector, which has re-rated meaningfully in the last 2 years. But there's lots of things in commercial real estate and other things where they really were dependent on incredibly low interest rates. Some of the solar companies have been leasing solar panels and financing at really, really low rates. I mean, the model just doesn't work at 6%, 7%, or 8% interest rates. That's number one. The other observation on your comment is that it's really, really hard to keep growing exponentially for a long period of time. The number of companies that you know have grown revenue at 25% or more for years and years and years is very few. You know, the law of large numbers becomes an anchor the bigger you get, and it just becomes increasingly hard to grow at 50% a year. You know, I think my good friend Elon Musk at Tesla is about to find that out, because people have 40 and 50%, you know, unit revenue growth for the next 10 years at this company. And if you extrapolate out those numbers, you'll realize he's pretty much going to be the entire auto industry, you know, in 10 years. And that's just not going to happen. Yeah. So, you know, it's very easy. We all as humans have recency bias. So it's all very easy for us to just say, well, they've grown at 40% for 3 or 4 years. They're going to keep growing at 40%, not understanding that incremental sales, the bigger you get harder and harder to achieve. And, you know, and that's just the fact. You can go back and look through financial history, and people have done that work. You know, how many companies in the dot-com era to today grew at 25%? I think it's a handful.
Yeah. And, you know, extrapolating that is, you know, as you mentioned, it's one of the key mistakes. And And so, you know, on that note, well, one more thing that we have seen as a result of these super low interest rates is, you know, within the private equity industry, and a lot of people have made this observation, is, you know, it made it very cheap to borrow a lot of money. And this has happened within corporate America, but just within the private equity industry, what we saw was it was very easy to borrow debt in order to finance acquisitions, et cetera. So within a higher interest rate environment, and assuming, you know, these higher interest rates persist for, say, the next decade, you know, what happens to places like the private equity industry? You know, do you think they have to, you know, slow down, you know, cost of capital goes up, et cetera? You know, what do you think is going to happen?
I mean, look, I got onto Wall Street at the peak of interest rates at 14% for U.S. governments in 1980. And the equity market was trading at around 6 or 7 times when I got onto Wall Street. So if I had told you then for the next 40 years, I knew for a fact that rates would go from 14% to zero, and multiples would go from 6 or 7 times to 20 times, I don't think you could have picked a better industry to start than private equity, right? You're basically going to buy equities on leverage. You're going to buy corporate equity on leverage and keep refinancing it and keep, you know, profiting from revaluation upward of multiples. And that's been, you know, the guys who started the private equity business back in the early 80s are all, you know, some of the richest people on the planet. And so that was the case in 1980 and 1981 and 82. Fast forward to today or last year, and you have the market at over 20 times earnings and you have interest rates pretty much at zero. Probably not the best time to be pouring tons of money into private equity, because if interest rates ever normalize over a longer period of time, you're not going to have that head tailwind anymore. It's going to be a headwind. And multiples may not keep going. They most likely won't keep going up. In fact, they very well could go down. So buying equities on leverage in 2021 and 2022 might turn out not to be the greatest business model going forward. And particularly if there's, you know, huge fees involved in the whole thing. So I am very worried about private equity as an investor. You know, just as endowments and pension funds have allocated more and more and more of their assets to private equity, it's probably a time you should be, you know, devoting fewer assets to private equity.
Yep. And maybe, you know, in 1980, you know, KKR should have been KKRC with the chain O's after the Roberts. Yep. You know, one of the things that you know, you recommended I do was read The Price of Time by Edward Chancellor. And you know, you absolutely love that book. So one of the things that's you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you on the topic of interest rates is sort of this question of, you know, who and how should interest rates be set, considering how, you know, interest rates have, one, to an extent, interest rates influence the price of everything, and two, you know, the lower interest rates that we've seen over the last 10 years have led to a lot of crazy valuations, a lot of bubbles, etc. So, you know, who and why, you know, who and how, in your opinion, should interest rates be set?
You know, again, we're getting a little bit afar of my field, but I would recommend Ed Chancellor's new book is fabulous. Mm-hmm. I give you a good grounding at just the history of interest rates and their impact on business and markets. Look, the world's central banks, I think, have an important role in setting short-term interest rates and being a lender of last resort in crisis and being regulators for financial stability. I mean, those three things, I think, are one of the important aspects of fiat currency that are important to keep. And my favorite financial fraudster of all time, John Law from the Mississippi scheme, you know, he understood that back in the early 1700s. He understood the weaknesses of fiat and the strengths of fiat, and the state's ability to intervene when necessary in times of crisis was one of the things he said gave the state an advantage. Now, having said that, I don't think that envisioned QE and QE forever and using the Fed's balance sheet on a semi-permanent basis to buy long-dated securities to try to keep long rates down. And that's a new development. right? That is something that is new to our generation. And I think that's where a lot of critics of central banks would say, this is not the original mission statement of a central bank. You know, you're supposed to keep liquidity flowing into the economy and setting rates on a short-term basis so that that's the case, and watching the banking system for safety and soundness, and acting as a lender of last resort with good collateral, as Walter Badgett pointed out back in the 19th century. But you know, then going out and buying mortgage-backed securities and government, long-term treasuries in an attempt to keep the yield curve from being too steep, or whatever you're trying to accomplish, then you begin to stray. Then you begin, and of course, we know the Swiss National Bank was buying equities. Who knows what the Japanese central bank was doing? So central banks became a power unto themselves in the 21st century. And, you know, we're all kind of paying the price for that, as you point out, with these booms and busts. Because at the end of the day, they're human like us, right? They make mistakes. Yeah. They're a committee. They get it wrong at turning points. And so letting the market do that, I think, to me, makes a lot more sense than letting, you know, five guys in a room try to figure out where long-term interest rates should be. Markets are complicated, and you know, they're best sorted out by themselves, as messy as that can be, and as much as you'd like to intervene. There are lots of unintended consequences when you do that. And I think that's what the Fed keeps kind of finding out.
Every now and then, yeah. You know, Jim, let's take a flight. Let's go to China. And so, you know, one of the things you've been extremely outspoken about was the Chinese real estate bubble. You know, we're finally starting to see it popping. So, you know, within that framework, you know, one of the things that you said, I think it was this, it was at the CNBC conference a couple of months ago, was, you know, you said that you noted that almost every large company in China has a real estate development arm. So it's not just the developers, it's endemic to the whole economy there. And, yeah. And then you said that, you know, we ignore that point at our own peril. So one, you know, when it comes to the sort of the follow through effects of the Chinese real estate bust, you know, one, you know, how would you actually play it when it comes to, you know, thinking about how to invest or how to short with that in mind?
I the simple answer is I wouldn't play it, right? So the first thing we tell our clients is just avoid China. I just avoid it. It's I know it's the siren song of 1.4 billion people who are kind of quasi-capitalist, but not really. And it's just been a sinkhole for capital. I mean, if you look at returns that Western investors have gotten in the Chinese markets, they're dreadful over time. When we went publicly bearish on China at the end of 2009, the FXI, which is the sort of Chinese SOE dollar denominated ETF, I think it was $40 or $41. It's now 27 or 28. It's down 50% in 12 years. Mm-hmm. And you know, most other markets have doubled and tripled at least since then. It's just capital is treated very poorly there. Western capital is treated even worse. The VIE structure is a nightmare for investors. You don't own the assets you think you do. And if you don't think I'm right, ask the bondholders of some of the Chinese real estate developers who bought their dollar-denominated bonds and have found out that they have no claim on the real estate back in China. And so it's just the whole structure of the Chinese economic and financial model is to basically exploit Western capital. And I can't stress that enough. And so if you're just a basic investor, just don't do it, yeah. Right? Trade with China, understand how China affects the commodity markets. Those are all valid things, but don't buy Chinese bonds and equities in New York or Toronto or London. You're going to be in for a rude awakening over time as investors keep finding out over and over and over again. That's number one. Number two, whatever the Chinese will tell you, they cannot let the real estate market bubble pop. So the you know, I think this past week they announced another rescue plan. It's the fourth rescue plan in 12 years that I've seen. You know, they every time they try to let the air out of the bubble, the economy goes into stall speed and they panic and they reverse themselves. So of course, real estate investors have gotten wise to that, right? So they Chinese real estate investors domestically do not think that their value of their apartments can go down. Of course they can, but there is a real one-way psychology in China, which has contributed to the bubble. The one thing that they think that can't happen keeps the bubble going for a while. So I remember early on when I would meet with Chinese investors, and I would always ask them, I said, well, does your family personally own real estate? And invariably they would say, oh yeah, we have three flats, or, you know, my grandmother has two, my father and mother have two, you know, my uncle has three in Beijing, whatever. It was always multiple apartments that I would hear about. And I would say, well, what happens if prices go down? Well, the government won't let that happen. And I would always smile and say, well, you know, I know you're not going to understand this maybe, but you're the government, right? That's your money. Doesn't show up from nowhere. And that concept was always alien to particularly to Chinese national investors, of the government was this deus ex machina, right? That was just separate from the people, and therefore that they could print money. And I said, of course they could do all that, but there's ultimate costs for that. It might be inflation, it might be higher interest rate, it might be all kinds of things, who knows? But it's not without risk. And that still seems lost on many Chinese investors in property. Now, some of them are finding it out now in a variety of different projects and developments. So we'll see. The problem is, of course, is that investment is still almost 50% of GDP in China, and residential investment is almost half of that. So, you know, residential real estate is 20 to 25% of the Chinese economy. And that's just unprecedented. I mean, no economy has had that number for more than a very brief period of time, and China's had it for years. So I like to joke China's one big sort of construction site, because it is.
It really is. And you know, just on that front, you know, with China, so one, on a long-term basis, both demographics look poor and the government policy and just local politics is not good. And then on a micro level, a lot of the economic data that China publishes is not really true. And then on top of that, you know, a lot of the Chinese company data that comes out, you know, financial statements, et cetera, are again, not necessarily true. So, you know, does this overall make China uninvestable? Like, would you just to put it flatly, would you just say China's uninvestable here?
I, as a Western investor, I think, you know, buying, sitting in Toronto or New York or wherever, you know, buying stocks and bonds, I think it's just incredibly difficult. And maybe it's, you know, if you're a good trader, timer, whatever, but as a fundamental long-term investor, you're going to be treated very badly. And the evidence is almost incontrovertible on that.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yep. You know, one of the things that I did want to discuss with you was, on a more general basis, if you could improve financial regulation in, you know, one or in many different ways, you know, how would you go about doing that? You know, considering your experience and your expertise within handling financial frauds, especially from a market practitioner standpoint, you know, how would you go about, fixing up some of the problems that, you know, markets as a whole have today?
Yeah. So if I was king, there'd be two areas, one regulatory and one law enforcement. The regulatory is easy. I would end this practice of pro forma earnings. If you want to put out a table in the back of your GAAP financial statements of pro forma metrics, that's fine. But no use in the press release, no use in promotional materials. You've got to use the GAAP statements, and I would really crack down on aggressive use of pro forma metrics overall. I just think they're highly misleading, and I would bring cases, you know, against people, companies for highly misleading use of pro forma metrics. on the law enforcement side, I would be much, much more aggressive in trying to prosecute financial crime. Prosecutors have long been reticent to prosecute financial fraud. As I joke in my class, you know, financial crime, unlike crimes of passion and crimes of opportunity, come with the alibis already built in, right? You get your accountants to sign off on things, you get your lawyers to sign off on things. And it's very hard to prosecute companies, particularly for accounting fraud, because everything gets signed off on, even if there's an intent to mislead. And so when people have brought cases, it's often been for simpler things like lying to investors, which juries can understand. But we have seen people, you know, correctly being sent to jail for accounting fraud in cases like WorldCom. And so I would, if I was running the Justice Department, have a full-time financial fraud task force going after companies, because so much money is stolen from investors through financial fraud. And there are exogenous effects on that. There are things that hurt society because of it. And this whole idea that it's too hard to prosecute and we don't want to lose the cases and blah, 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 blah. If you don't bring the cases, how do you know that? And these cases aren't even brought anymore. It's just so rare to see a financial fraud case like Theranos brought. That's the other thing I would do. I would get really, really strict about financial fraud and going after it and try to restore confidence with investors on that front.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And just on that pro forma note, one of the common practices of companies is to provide sort of guidance estimates for, say, the next quarter or the next year and so on. One of the things is, sometimes these tend to come about in made up metrics, say adjusted EBITDA. And, Warren Buffett has talked about this dynamic of how, CEOs and managers wanting to make the numbers eventually end up making up the numbers if needed to do so. And, especially with these adjusted EBITDA numbers, it becomes very, very easy to manipulate a lot of this information. So, overall, how would you sort of improve the financial information that is provided? Would you sort of outlaw, or would you sort of, reduce to, say, a footnote, sort of these adjusted EBITDA numbers? Because these are what, say, companies like Uber and Lyft measure their performance on. And essentially, they're just measuring their performance on how well they can adjust or how well they can add back numbers to say, EBITDA or net income.
Yeah, well, again, I would try to crack down on that practice and also, either litigate or prosecute in cases where it was egregious, so that managements would think twice about trying to fool people that way. Ever since we've had in the States, ever since we had the PSLRA, the Public Securities Litigation Reform Act in the mid-90s, which kind of defanged the ability of the plaintiff's bar to go after companies for this stuff by giving managements pretty wide safe harbor to make projections, saying, you can't hold us to these, but here's what we think. Here's our opinion. It's been really hard to go after companies for projections and guidance. That's been the case now for 25 years. But where there clearly is companies going over the line, I think, judicious prosecution could work wonders in trying to clean up management misbehavior in this area, because it is rampant.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Now, Jim, that sort of brings us to the end of our conversation. Before I let you go, do you have any closing thoughts or closing statements that you want to share?
I think we covered a lot of ground, Sri. I think that, investors are it's important for investors to challenge that which they're hearing or reading in the financial press or watching on financial TV. And do their own work and read the financial statements themselves and not get caught up on sexy stories and try to understand when they invest, does this business make sense? Is it profitable? How can it be more profitable? How could it go wrong? And how is management telling me the truth about my business if I'm providing them capital? Or is management just glossing over and making things up, as you point out? And I think they would save themselves a lot of money over the long run if they learned to do that. So that's my parting words.
Awesome. Jim, with that, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Listeners, you can find Jim on Twitter at Wall Street Cynic. So at Wall ST Cynic. So with that, Jim, thank you so much for being on. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, Sri. It was fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.